Morning. I'd like to call to order today's meeting of the House Judiciary Policy and Finance Committee, today, February 26, 2004. Clerk, would you take the roll?
Chairman Smith.
Here.
Representative Eastland. Anderson. Blaine.
Here.
Ellison.
Here.
Fuller.
Here.
Hillstrom.
Here.
Hilty.
Here.
Johnson.
Here.
Lesh.
Here.
Lippman.
Here.
Meslow.
Here.
Murphy.
Here.
Paymar.
Here.
Hall.
Here.
Rhodes.
Here.
Soderstrom.
Here.
Strand.
Here.
Tao.
Here.
Walls.
Here.
Chair notes that we do have the presence of a quorum, so we'll first item we'll take up is the consideration of the minutes from the meeting on February 25, 2004. Representative Lippman moves approval of the minutes. Are there any questions or additions or corrections? Seeing none, those in favor say aye.
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 Those opposed say no. Motion approved and the minutes are approved. The item on today's agenda is House File 1602, authored by Representative Hackbarth. It is the death penalty authorized for first-degree murder under aggravating circumstances, statutory framework provided, automatic appellate review provided, task forces established, and money appropriated. Is there a motion on this bill?
Mr. Chairman, I'll make a motion that House File 1602 pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Civil Law.
All right. The bill is before the committee. I note that there is what would be an author's, or what is an author's amendment in the file labeled A04-0938. Is there, Representative Hackbarth, is that an amendment that you choose to have the bill placed in the form you want to present to this committee?
Mr. Chairman, that's correct. It's the legal amendment to get the bill in the shape that I'd like.
Representative Waltz.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to move the A04-0938 amendment.
All right. Representative Waltz moves the A04-0938 amendment. Any discussion? Those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say no. Motion prevails. We have House File 1602 as amended by the author's amendment before us. Representative Hackbarth, I'd ask that you present the bill at this time. If you have any initial presenters to assist you, then go ahead.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman and members, and I'd like to thank the chairman and members for hearing this bill today. It's been a long time since this issue has been before the legislature. It's been here in various forms as amendments on the floor, etc., but I don't remember the last time it might have had a hearing in a committee. So thank you for that, for bringing this forward. This issue was, and I should add that I have Mr. Kittle with me today from the revisor's office. Mr. Kittle has done a lot of research in this area and has actually put the bill together for us, and he'll be hitting some of the highlights of the bill after I have some brief comments. Chairman, Mr. Chairman and members, I brought this bill forward today because I in the past have not been a supporter of capital punishment, but back in about 1992 there was an incident that brought my attention to this issue. As I was campaigning in 1992, constituents of my district were asking me about this issue, and I was not initially in support, but at that time an incident happened in Champlin, Minnesota, where an individual went into a home during the day. The home was empty, ransacked the home, ate the food that was in the house, watched television and videotapes all day long in this home. The mother came home in the afternoon after she got done with her job, after she picked up the kids at daycare. That individual then murdered the mother, murdered the toddler, and stabbed the baby in its crib. The baby did survive. The mother and the toddler did not. I thought that was a very heinous crime, a very heinous murder situation, and it has turned me around on capital punishment since that time. Members, constituents in my district very much support capital punishment. I've had this on various questionnaires throughout my legislative career, and it always comes back. Very, very high percentages of folks in my district support capital punishment. So, when I was first elected in 1994, Hilda Betterman was here. She had a bill, and we tried to offer that on the House floor, and it was defeated. I was a co-author of that bill at the time, and then Hilda Betterman did not come back, and no one else was taking up the issue, so I put a bill together, and I've been trying to refine this ever since. As you might know, there's been problems in other states with capital punishment. We try to address many of those issues in this bill. We've taken that into consideration. Mr. Kittle has done a lot of research over the years on those things, and he knows the ins and outs and the problems that other states have had. We've tried to solve that in this bill. So, Mr. Chairman and members, at this time, I would like to turn the testimony over to Mr. Kittle from the Revisor's Office, and he's going to hit on some of the high points of the bill, what's in it, and maybe even on some of those things where other states have had some problems, and how we solve some of those things in this bill. Mr. Kittle?
I have been working on the death penalty bill.
Yes.
Well, my name is Robert Kittle. I'm Assistant Deputy Revisor from the Revisor's Office. I was first asked to work upon a death penalty bill right after the U.S. Supreme Court determined that the death penalty statutes of other states were unconstitutional. So I've been working on this piece of legislation off and on for nearly 30 years. And I'd like to go highlight the various articles and how they each work and how they're intended to provide maximum justice for everybody, the defendant and the victim, survivors, as well as public safety.
Mr. Kittle, before we start, I think it's appropriate in part because we have a number of witnesses. Chair will entertain questions as we go along, especially for you, the presenter, or the assisting in presenting. If there are any questions on the technicalities of any of the parts of the bill, feel free to raise your hand and seek recognition. We'll want to see that the answers, if any, are asked and answered as we go along. Mr. Kittle, go ahead.
Okay. The first article is the constitutional amendment, and the constitutional amendment has to be voted on by the voters, and if it's not adopted, of course, none of the other provisions go into effect. If it's adopted, there's a phased-in time effect for all the other provisions. The main set of provisions in the bill is in Article 2, which I'll spend most of the time and try to highlight a few things in it, some of which answer some of the problems that have been in other states. In Article 2, Section 3, Subdivision 1, 244A.03, there are no... Subdivision 2 excludes a number of situations where the death penalty can be applied. Namely, one of them that I can mention is that the death penalty will not apply to juveniles. The Supreme Court of the United States recently has agreed to take up a case, and the flow of events seems to be that juveniles might not be constitutional to have juveniles receive the death penalty. Number two, the preclusion of the death penalty. This is a provision, Subdivision 3, which tries to incorporate the governor's provisions to make sure that innocent defendants don't receive the death penalty. The provisions that the governor proposed basically came out of the leading commission and study of the death penalty in the Illinois Commission, and it precludes the death penalty in cases, unless there's a DNA link, you can't have a death penalty. And then there's some limitations on having a death penalty when there's lack of evidence. For instance, if there's only a single eyewitness or a single accomplice or in custody informant, you can't have the death penalty. And the concept, as you all know in criminal law, is you have to prove something beyond a reasonable doubt. Advocates or opponents of the death penalty or critics of it have wanted to tighten things up to make sure, absolutely sure, as humanly possible, that no innocent defendants are convicted. And the latest one that I'm aware of is a public defender's office in New York suggested that there be a higher standard, and I have that in Subdivision 3, a standard of proof beyond any doubt. Then in the next one, the aggravating circumstances. These are the circumstances under which the death penalty will be allowed. Under the original Supreme Court ruling in 1972, The Supreme Court doctrine is that you try to just convict the very worst of the worst offenders, and there has to be some kind of structure. Again, the governor took up the Illinois Commission, authorizing only very limited circumstances for the imposition of the death penalty. Namely, at this time of the death, at the time there has to be two or more murdered, a murder of a public safety officer, or a particularly heinous murder, or a criminal sex murder. And one of the problems with death penalties in other states is has been that there's been too many aggravating circumstances. Reducing it to just four tries to hit the Supreme Court's criteria of worst offenders. Another important provision, I tried to incorporate all the recent U.S. constitutional law. Mentally retarded persons can no longer be subject to the death penalty under Aikens versus Virginia. That's in Section 4. And in Section 5, 244A.05, in the imposition of the death penalty, a recent case of 2 years ago requires that the jury and not the judge unanimously find aggravating circumstances before the death penalty can be imposed. In addition, according to the Illinois Commission, which is probably the best and most comprehensive recent study of the death penalty, they said to add a further safeguard to that, the court has to concur in that, otherwise it'll be lowered to a lesser sentence. That's in there. And let's see. Then the other provisions in Article 2 are all necessary procedural administrative provisions to enforce the death penalty. In Section 7, for instance, the judiciary, the Supreme Court, has a complex series of reviews of the death penalty. I've included in that the proportionality review, where the Supreme Court tries to ascertain if all the death penalty circumstances fit into this narrow worst of worst category, and it also in that is looking at discrimination and disparities. Many of the states recently, because of various criticisms and problems with the administration of the death penalty, have had commissions go out and look, study the problems of disparities in imposition of the sentence. The two main areas, of course, are racial disparity, which is a big problem, and then there's geographical disparity. In many of the jurisdictions, for instance, in California, in a county that has Los Angeles, there's a great many death penalty cases, whereas in San Francisco there isn't. In Texas, Dallas has few, Houston has many. So that's a problem I address in the best practices in Article 4, which I'll get to, which I will get to next. This, in after working on the death penalty and seeing all the problems and the complexities involved in it, I tried to figure out what would be a way to address all the problems that arose in the other states. I went to a CLE at William Mitchell, where Professor Joseph Liebman of Columbia Law School, who was the head of the study that found all these errors in the various states, and I, at the CLE, I asked him, what should you do if you're going to have a death penalty to try to obviate all these errors? And he suggested that you come up with a what he called a best practices model. Some states do it better than other states, and they devote better resources. So what I tried to do was incorporate that concept in the concept of the chapter Article 4, which I'll now go to, the best practices capital punishment model. What I finally came up with to try to conceptually handle all these various problems with the death administration of the death penalty is to create a capital punishment policy committee, which is modeled upon the Sentencing Guidelines Commission. The Sentencing Guidelines Commission was created by the legislature almost 25 years ago, and one of the primary purposes of that was to address the problem of disparity in sentencing. under the indeterminate sentencing scheme. Like if you were in Rochester, the Twin Cities, or the St. Louis, or Duluth, you might receive three disparate sentences, even though it was the same crime under similar circumstances. So the legislature came up with the idea of having a guidelines model. The idea under they have death penalty guidelines is similar, only here you would be trying to use the model in a rather narrow or more complex area of trying to have a commission come up with death penalty guidelines, which would try to create a matrix which would analyze life imprisonment, life without the possibility of parole, and then the very extremely rare death penalty. And one of the problems that the other states that have had the death penalty historically going back years and years is that the various elements of the criminal justice system sometimes have problems because they're in conflict with each other. Like the prosecution wants to prosecute and get convictions, and then oftentimes one of the problems has been that the defense side of it has been underfunded. And so all these have resulted in a great many problems, and the various states have come up with various task forces after the fact. In the Capital Punishment Policy Commission, what I create, instead of doing something after something goes wrong, I create, on the model of the sentencing guidelines, something that will look at all this right now and look at all the problems. And the commission, which is composed of criminal justice people from all the elements plus public members, will look at all these various things. And they'll look at the best practices and come up with safeguards. First, they'll come. In order to try to make this a little shorter, I'll try to combine it with a timeline for it. The commission will set up task forces of the judicial, prosecutorial, and defense functions and look at specific recommendations that the Illinois Commission made. And there was an earlier commission about 3 years ago called the Constitution Project, made up of leading scholars from all over the country that came up with recommendations, which I have included in Article 2. And each of these task forces has 6 months from January 2005, after the adoption of the constitutional amendment, to July, when they can make recommendations. During this period, the idea is that, for instance, the defense task force, which will be composed of the state public defender and other defense attorneys, will come up with various recommendations for the commission. And one of the main recommendations would probably be the ABA guidelines, which require and provide extensive training, and the idea of which is to get the defense function in the death penalty cases to have similar training and resources as the prosecutorial function. Many of the states that use the death penalty the most have the poorest resources and poorest defense systems. In Minnesota, which is uniquely known for its good public defense systems, this would get a level playing field, and this would also help in cutting down on the innocents. And all these various best practices recommendations would be synthesized and put together by the commission between July of 2005 and January of 2006. And then the commission would, which is, has duties in Article 4, to come up with the death penalty guidelines. And then there's a second large element in it, which is also is part of the governor's recommendations and comes from specifically from the Illinois Commission Task Force, is that one of the large problems with the death penalty has been the different administration of the death penalty in various jurisdictions. Some county attorneys are very aggressive and go after it, and some don't go after it at all, so we have all these disparities. The idea with the capital review panel would be to look at the decision of a county attorney. The county attorney, of course, first would be looking at the death penalty guidelines to see if this was a death eligible case. Then the capital review panel, which would be composed of the managing attorney in the attorney general's office, who would be in charge of death penalty prosecutions, three county attorneys chosen by the County Attorneys Association, and a retired judge would review that. So instead of having this sort of fragmented decision making with respect to the administration of the death penalty, you would have a system-wide collaborative partnership between the criminal justice system and the three branches of government, executive, judicial, and legislative, deciding this, and you'd get, and hopefully by this sort of review and collaboration, many of the problems of racial discrimination and disparities would be kept out. Then, in addition, there's a task force on a cost study which would go into great depth about how much it would cost. Of course, one of the things everybody's aware of is that the death penalty is enormously costly in many states. And this task force would base its figures on costs in Minnesota, plus the specific nature of the death penalties situation. A fifth and final task force would be to study what kind of certification and education would be necessary. As you're probably all well aware, the death penalty is a whole quantum leap from up in complexity from regular criminal practice, and many of the problems in other jurisdictions have been the fact that people, that the attorneys appointed by the judges and whatnot, have not had the experience or practice. This has finally dawned, and all the various task forces have pointed to this. So I've included an element whereby the CLE, the State Court Education Committee, will come up with some kind of plan which would allow for certification of the judges and sort of everybody else. And then the plan is provided that on January 1st, the 2006 legislature would be able to look at the best practices model, the death penalty guidelines, cost studies, and revisions in law. Now, the Capital Punishment Policy Commission, where the death penalty would reside, would not only be in statute, it would be in court rules, the death penalty, and it'd be often a bewildering vast variety of forms. For instance, the recommendations of the Illinois Commission, which are the most complete, have a great number of recommendations relating to the law enforcement function and the investigation and interrogation rules, like eyewitness testimony and things like that. I've recently read, both in the experience of Illinois and Oklahoma, which are death penalty states, where there was a lot of overreaching by law enforcement and the prosecutors going after death penalty cases. There are certain problems, one of them being, there probably isn't time to go into them, but this could be sort of a policy model, just like the racial profiling, where the post board could come up with some rules. And the whole idea would be that the whole criminal justice system would be improved to a point where some of the excesses and problems in other jurisdictions wouldn't occur. Finally, the Supreme Court is requested to draw jury instructions in Minnesota. Recently, as you're all aware, there's a great talk about the sex offender problem and the use of possible life in prison or life without possibility of release. If a jury had adequate instructions telling them about the options of the death penalty or life without the possibility of release, this would probably, according to a lot of the literature, involve fewer people getting the death sentence. So under this system, those who got the death penalty imposed upon them in Minnesota would probably be a very small number. And with most of the other people or other defendants getting the life without release or just life imprisonment. And if the legislature took a look at all this in the 2006 session, made any changes it wanted to, and then if it went through, it'd become effective May 1st, 2006, but then I give time for all the various agencies to adopt all the complex structures, do the training and everything and get used to it before the death penalty would go into effect, and it would affect only homicides committed after January 1st, 2007. Now, there's subtler aspects to it in the United States, as most of you probably know. 75% of the states, or 38 states, have the death penalty, and the federal government has it, and there are 12 states, New England and in the West, that don't have the death penalty. And the culture in Minnesota since 1911, when the death penalty was abolished by the legislature, has been strongly against it, just the opposite mirror image of what it is in the 38 other states. So if a death penalty, if this, for the sake of argument, was actually passed, there would be great reluctance to immediately use it. So in the first years of the existence of it, there would probably be very few prosecutions brought. And the idea would be that there wouldn't be sort of mistakes made in this or that jurisdiction, that the Capital Review Commission would have a good hold on it. And then lastly, I'd like to just explain that the Capital Punishment Policy Commission, which holds such a special place, sort of has a role that task forces in other states have, only they have much more dynamic role. In addition to those ones I mentioned, there'd be three legislators on it. All the task force, the main ones, the Constitutional Project and the Illinois Commission, had people on it who were opposed to the death penalty as well as proponents, and they worked together to get the best possible system. So I would imagine in the Minnesota situation, for instance, you might have a legislative person like Representative, I won't make specific references, but people who are not necessarily opposed to it, who are opposed to it and who are for it, and they, working together, they might come out with the best possible sort of situation and adjust continuously to any new needs. And with that, I'll stop.
Very good. Anything further, Representative Packard?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I think you can see that Mr. Kittle has worked very, very hard on this, and I don't know if there's a better expert on this issue than Mr. Kittle in the state of Minnesota. And he's done a wonderful, tremendous job of putting this together. Members, I'm not an attorney. Probably shouldn't be the individual representative that should be carrying this legislation because I'm not an attorney. I don't know the ins and outs of court proceedings, etc. But I do feel very strongly about the policy issue. And I think you can see that this is a very, very good plan to put this into effect in the state of Minnesota. I think it's kind of a standard for the whole nation to look at. It's a very, very good bill. With that, Mr. Chairman, I know there's a lot of people that would like to testify on the bill.
First, we're going to, as I announced earlier, if there's questions of the presenter at this time, we will go to those first. Representative Lippman, then Hillstrom, then Tao. Representative Lippman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have lots, but I'll just do two, and both are on a similar subject with regards to the court's role in all of this. Mr. Chairman, Mr. Kittle, I guess I have a question about what I would call judicial nullification. Do you see that there is a danger that a district court judge would never concur with a jury's finding that death should be imposed, or an appellate court judge at the Supreme Court level would always find that the death sentence is disproportionate, both on moral grounds? Is that a danger that we could pass this legislation, but that there might be judges who would never vote to impose?
Mr. Kittle.
Well, that's a difficult question. One of the things that I considered in this is the fact that when you have the criminal justice system working each in their own sort of area, they each have their own specific culture, like judges, prosecutors, or defense. And as you well know, the death penalty is probably the most controversial, complex subject in criminal justice, and there might people feel very strongly one way or another about it. And the best way I can try to explain how this bill would try to deal with that is the fact that before the death penalty is actually applied, there'd be a two-year period. Assuming, for the sake of argument, the constitutional amendment passed, then you'd have 2005 and 2006 when this commission would be doing its work. And in the state of Minnesota, there's no one living who ever did the death penalty in Minnesota. They might have did pro bono in other states. So you would have members of the judges, and I've put a lot of people on the commission, trial, appellate court judges, and then prosecutors and legislators and victim representatives. So the idea that would be that these people would have, if the thing passed, would have this mission, this moral and policy mission from the legislature to collaborate like the other task forces in the other states to come up with the best solutions for this. Even though individually a legislator on it might oppose the death penalty, they'd still try to get the best result, just like the Illinois Commission did. For instance, the Illinois Commission results, were a lot of them were passed in November over a governor's veto. So the judges, hopefully the collective influence of the Supreme Court justices on it, plus the trial court justices, Chief Justice, the Chief of the Appellate Court of Appeals, and then the Chief of the District Court Conference, would all have meetings, and they'd all sort of try to enforce informal norms on this, and they try to get everybody to buy into this with the idea that this system of justice has admitted it. Minnesota is a very complex, delicate balance between making sure the defendant has all his or her super due process rights, and the victims, survivors, get their rights and respect, and then the public safety is made.
Mr. Chairman,
Representative Lippman,
Mr. Kittle, you mentioned the chief judge's role, and my other question has to do with that. Is there any constitutional or policy tension by having the chief judge both in the accelerated review process as a member of the Supreme Court, and then also one-third of the Board of Pardons, you know, presumably on any later petition for relief or reprieve? Is there anything that we should be concerned about the chief judge playing both of those roles?
Mr. Kittle.
You bring up a very good and very subtle sort of point. And on that particular issue, the Clemency Board, the Board of Pardons, which the Chief Judge is on, the Governor is on, and the Attorney General is on, is a constitutional amendment. So in Article 3, there's a commutation, Board of Commutation. These are sort of very complicated ethical sort of things that the Commission and the judges would have to sort of decide. And maybe one possible solution would be for not the Chief Justice, who's on the board, being on the commission, but a delegate, one of the other judges. Chief Justice is probably one that's head of the, I would imagine there'll be a great big rule of criminal procedure, death penalty procedures in there, and have him on it, him or her on it.
All right, very good. Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Kittle, is it true that rather than putting this on the ballot and making this a political issue, that those who are in favor of this issue could simply reinstate the death penalty in this state if they got enough legislative support and the governor was willing to sign it?
Mr. Kittle.
Okay, that's a rather delicate, complicated thing, and I'm supposed to be nonpartisan, but I try to set it up as best I can. In 1911, when the legislature abolished the capital punishment, there was no direct provision in the Minnesota Constitution authorizing it. But there was a sort of, Article 1, Section 7, there was a mention, except for capital, and they sort of made the inference that there was capital punishment. But there was no direct need for it. Now, theoretically, you could introduce the bill without the constitutional amendment, that's how I originally drafted it, but it sort of becomes a policy or political question, because if you enacted, tried to enact the bill without the constitutional amendments, given the reality of the situation, especially given Minnesota's culture, there would probably be very many people who would immediately bring suit in the Minnesota Supreme Court. Now, the United States Supreme Court still hasn't determined under the federal constitution that the death penalty is cruel and unusual punishment. But in the last 20 years or so, the Minnesota Supreme Court has occasionally interpreted its own constitution, and theoretically they could interpret it to be cruel and unusual punishment.
Mr. Chair, follow-up.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you. Do you believe that in the event that a constitutional amendment then passed, that they wouldn't also do those same challenges? So,
knowing, being an attorney and knowing attorneys, they probably would, but with the constitutional amendment passing, I think it would be maybe a little bit more difficult to carry the day.
Thank you.
Okay, I think we're getting a little far afield if we're getting into opinions as to what might happen after this bill passes or doesn't pass. So let's try to stay questions on this bill. Representative Tao.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Kittle, your report, you talked a little bit about racial disparity. Can you share that number with us? And do you anticipate having the same racial disparity in Minnesota if we do institute it?
I have to admit that the racial discriminatory effect is one of the most intractable, difficult sort of things. It has been all over the country, and there's been any number of studies, and the fact is that if you're a black victim, you're not as likely to have the death penalty brought as if you're a white victim. And there have been, you know, discriminatory applications of it in various southern states. Part of it, I think, is attributable to just general societal discrimination that's sort of deeply embedded in the society. And then there might be certain aspects, I don't want to say bad things about other states, but there might be certain aspects of cultures in other states which are not as enlightened as they should be with respect to race, racial sort of things. But then even with the sentencing guidelines, there was some sort of problems, I believe, a number of years ago pointed out in reports about racial and discriminatory aspects of it. And one of the things that I've tried to do to the best of my ability in this bill is to try to set up various mechanisms to deal with this. One of the things in the death penalty situation is there's going to be vastly fewer people doing it. And if you have this central death penalty guidelines plus the commission looking at it, and first of all, here's how it plays out. If you're a county attorney and you say, well, this might be a death eligible crime, you have to go through a bunch of criteria, some of which involve the discriminatory thing, and then you go up to the Capital Review Board and they look at it. And so it isn't as if you're going to get, for instance, a whole bunch of death penalty cases brought against racial minorities in the center cities and then have less cases brought against the Caucasians out in the outer sort of thing. So you'll be having the commission look at it, and then, of course, at the end, the Supreme Court looks at it because there's proportionality review. And thinking about this specific issue, because the governor mentioned it when the whole issue first came up, one of my ideas was that if all this for sake of argument was passed, one of the astute things when Minnesota to administer this will, of course, will have to go out and get people in, from the other 38 states or the federal government to manage and run the system, because they have all the experience, and because this is so complex, you need a lot of experience. And there will be a main manager in the state public defender's office and an attorney general's office. It might be very wise, not only from a political but from a legal standpoint, to hire a minority to do it. And just going ahead, looking into a crystal ball, the first few years, if this was in existence, I imagine everybody will be extremely hyper-aware of all these various problems and factors, so they'll be looking at the fact that, okay, in this county there's so many persons of a minority were death eligible, and the idea is that they're going to be looking for specific intentional discrimination and just discriminatory aspects of it where, for some reason or other, a minority might be overrepresented in the death eligible. And I think all these people working together, and then finally, the last thing, there will be on, as I mentioned, three legislators from each of the branches watching it, like Representative Ellison, Keith Ellison would be the excellent person to be on it because he's sort of against it, so he'd make sure everybody watch this issue very closely. And I think in Minnesota, given the fact that the first few years the media will be all over, everybody be very cautious about any discriminatory aspects to it.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Representative Powell.
Mr. Kittle. So in a short answer, yes, we will have see racial disparity in Minnesota as well.
Minnesota, although we all like to think of Minnesota as being uniquely nice and everything, we're still part of the whole country, and the whole country has certain problems. So I've tried to, as best as humanly possible, built in things to handle that particular problem. All the details of it and how it can be improved, maybe you would sleep a little better, is that under this plan, if the constitutional amendment is passed, this commission and the 30 people on the commission would be sort of like a preliminary bill. They go back and they look at all this, and then they improve it, and they improve the procedures and the various things to take the discrimination out of it as far as humanly possible. But I know what you're saying. It might be one of these. There are some very difficult sort of issues in this area, and it'd be foolish for me to say that the bill presently solves all of them. It'll take the collective intelligence and genius of all the better minds than mine in Minnesota's criminal justice system to solve it if they're able to.
Very good. Representative Powell.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Hackbarth, in Article 4, just a quick scan of that, shows that we're establishing policy committee, research director, a clearinghouse, office space, administrative services, a review panel, database, services unit, another task force. No specific money appropriated for that. In Article 5, we see that there are appropriations for public safety, Board of Public Defense, Attorney General, counties, Supreme Court, and district courts. But again, the amounts there are blank in the bill. No money appropriated. And my question is when are the citizens of the state going to know just how much all this is going to cost?
Representative Hackbarth.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Paul, I think Mr. Kittle wants to say a few words on that, but I will tell you, Mr. Representative Paul, and the chairman, that we did apply for a fiscal note on this bill, and I believe they just finished the fiscal note on the bill, but not to the amendment. So now we're probably going to have to have them do another one on the amendment, but I think Mr. Kittle has some comments on that issue too.
Mr. Kittle, your comments, please make them brief. We have at least 14 witnesses that we are going to get to this morning. Go ahead.
There's a task force that looks into this, and the idea is that you won't know if it's going into effect unless the constitutional amendments pass, and if that's passed, then the commission will decide how much all this costs, and in their package to the legislature in 2006, they'll fill in the figures for each of the criminal justice agencies, how much money is needed.
Representative Ellison.
Mr. Chair, so at this time, am I correct, Representative Hackbarth, in concluding that there is no fiscal note for the amendment? Is that right?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Ellison, that is correct.
But the fiscal note on the earlier bill, isn't it true that there was one that was presented today?
Representative Chair, Representative Ellison, I have not seen it, but I understand that it was finished today, and I don't know if there was one delivered to my office yet today or not, but I was just told during the committee that the fiscal note on the bill is done. but not on the amendment, which varies greatly.
Sure. Now, recognizing that, am I correct in assuming that this would come out of the Department of Corrections budget?
Representative Hackbar.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Kittle, I'm not sure what we... I don't know.
Well, Mr. Carter, will defer to you for enlightening us on that question.
Mr. Chair, committee members, we just received the fiscal note this morning. It is not on the amendment, but it does have some cost to the different agencies, Secretary of State, the Attorney General, Finance Department, the Supreme Court Public Defense Board, and the Corrections Department.
Representative Ellison.
Mr. Chair, so I think I'm correct in saying that we had about a 7% cut in the Department of Corrections budget last year, maybe perhaps 10% in the Public Defender budget last year, and yet we're looking at, in the first year, in 3 years out, upwards of $3.7 million based on the fiscal note that we do have. Is that a correct statement,
Mr. Carter?
Mr. Chair? Mr. Chair, Representative Ellison, it's probably a little, the public defenders were held harmless with the copay, but of course that is now, the courts decided that was unconstitutional. So their cut is somewhere, I would say, around that percent. Corrections, I think, was 7%, and the estimate done for 07 on the fiscal note is around $3.7 million.
Representative Ellison.
So, Mr. Chair, Representative Hackbar, do you believe we have the money to pay for the death penalty, given the cuts that we've already experienced last year and given the $3.7 million that we're looking at by 07?
Representative Hackbar.
Mr. Chair, Representative Ellison, I believe that if we bring this bill before the people to vote on the November ballot, they will decide whether they think we should put this in place and whether we should spend the money on it.
Mr. Chair,
Ellison.
Briefly, I'm going to round up, Mr. Chair. Mr. Representative Hackbar, I mean, isn't it the responsibility of the legislators to keep an eye on the budget of this state? I mean, by putting this into a constitutional amendment, aren't we simply throwing something on the public and sort of washing our hands of being good, faithful observers of the budget of the state, which we've sworn to do?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Ellison, when I originally drafted this bill, I wanted the legislature to make the decision on the issue. As I talked to my constituents and other legislators, they preferred that we take this to the people and let the people decide on the issue.
Just to correct
Representative Ellison.
Mr. Chair, just to take a slightly different tack, because I know that there are testifiers who want to come up and I want to have everyone get a chance to speak. I'm looking at page 4 under the amendment. Under aggravating circumstances. Mr. Chair, recognizing that any family that loses a loved one is devastated, it's a tragic lifetime hurt that people will suffer from, could you please share with us how we're going to distinguish between, when it comes to aggravated circumstances, how will we distinguish between especially cruel as opposed to simply cruel, or especially depraved as opposed to simply depraved? I mean, aren't we opening up a certain amount of discretion, randomness, arbitrariness when we define terms this way? Mr. Chair?
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Hackbar.
Representative Ellison, you could be right, but that's why we put some of the safeguards in the bill for these panels and commissions to look at these things as the case is brought forward and before the prosecuting attorney can make a decision on whether he wants to bring the case as a capital case.
I'll defer to other speakers now.
Okay. Representative Hillstrom, did you have a question on this point? Because we have Representatives Johnson, Strawn, and Hilty waiting. Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I actually have a question on a statement that was just made by Representative Hackbarth. Representative Hackbarth, you commented that the public would be making the decision on whether or not we could afford to do this. How is it that they are going to make that decision when they are not going to be told how much it's going to cost until after the vote?
Representative Hackbar.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hillstrom, I'm sure if this is put on the ballot, there will be a lot of debate on the issue. It will be in the news. It will be in the media. That's one of the things that's going to be considered, and I'm sure the people will know how much the bill is going to cost before they vote on it.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think my question was answered. It did have to do with cost as well as far as paying for the commission and paying for this bill, and it appears that there are no plans at this point to cover the cost of those that would be incurred, and that's all I need to know. Thank
Representatives,
you.
Thank you. Representative Strawn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll be brief. There's sort of three elements to the this debate, Representative Hackworth. There's a moral element and a practical element as far as whether it reduces crime, and then there's a financial element, which we're sort of discussing now, and I've already expressed my strong opposition to the death penalty bill on both moral and practical grounds. But if we're going to talk about the financial element, you're talking about the fiscal note, do you think it would be a good idea for us to wait until the forecast is out later this week before we move forward and consider this, or not?
Representative Hackbarth.
Well, this bill really doesn't, you know, have an effect on our current budget. We're going to have to come back next year, redo another budget, and I don't know if this bill is really going to affect our next biennium either. If we pass this, it looks like it's going to be further out than that, so I don't think. Mr. Kittle?
Mr. Kittle.
Did you have a comment?
Thank you.
It's probably going to be further out because if it passes, then the commission has to do work, and it'll be in the 2006 legislature that'll get the report, and then you'll get projections of how many death penalty cases, how much it's going to cost for each agency, and so it's probably the 2006 legislature that'll have to appropriate significant sums. Before then, you'll just have small appropriations, maybe for the commission and things like that.
Okay, Representative Hilty.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Hackworth, in your mind, is this bill primarily about retribution or is it about deterrence?
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Hackworth.
Representative Hilty, I think it's both. I mean, it's a policy issue that I've heard from the people of Minnesota, primarily in my district, I must have to admit, that they wanted me to bring this forward. I've been working on it, like I say, since I was first elected. The people in my district would like to see this brought forward. I think if you look at the state of Minnesota, the citizens of the state of Minnesota would like to see this happen. Unfortunately, it's the legislature, both the House and the Senate, that are blocking what the people of the state of Minnesota want to see. And we need to bring this forward, and I would hope that at least the House would get this thing done.
Well, Mr. Chair,
Representative Hilty.
Representative Hackbarth, I don't know that you actually answered my question, but just to follow up insofar as that, as you feel that this is about deterrence, what evidence do you have to suggest that the death penalty in states where it does exist serves as a deterrent?
Representative Hackbarth.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hilty, I don't have any statistics on that issue at all. People have told me that statistics say that it is not a deterrent, but in my mind that somebody that commits a heinous murder and we put that person to death after he's found guilty, that person is not going to be causing another murder, and that in itself is a deterrent.
Representative Hilty? Hold your applause and wait till the hearing is over. Give these committee members of mine the respect that they deserve, because we're trying to focus on this issue. Thank you, audience. Representative Hilty.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, Representative Hackbarth, I find a kind of discrepancy in the assumptions that seem to underlie this bill, in that the very crimes that are described, and I'm sure that, you know, this was not in the public's mind until very recently with the Drew Shadeen case. And I'm sure that crimes of that nature are ones that most people have in mind when they think that the death penalty would be a good idea. Yet, it seems to me that almost invariably crimes of that nature are such that there would be no possible deterrent, because people do not commit those crimes rationally or thinking about possible consequences. I don't see that this would accomplish what people think it would accomplish. I'd be interested in your comments on that.
Well, Mr. Chair?
Representative Hackbar, if there is a question that's been asked of you on the contents of the Delete All Bill amendment, please go forward. Otherwise, we have one more question, and then we're going to get the testimony. Representative Hackbar.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would just say that this has not just been brought to light because of the Drew Shedeen case. I've been working on it for many years. Like I say, it's been an issue in my district for a long, long time, and since I've been working on it, there's been case after case after case very similar to the Drew Shedeen case, and I just disagree.
Very good. Representative Rhodes. You have
thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Kittler, Representative Hackbarth, I'm concerned if it's a constitutional amendment that if there is a horrendous crime right before the vote is taken, right before the election, that that could skew how people react to voting on this constitutional amendment. So the question would be on other states that have the death penalty, do you have a kind of percentage of how many had a constitutional amendment, how many were enacted by the legislature?
Mr. Chairman,
Representative Hackbarth, any thoughts?
Mr. Kittle, do you have any idea? I don't know. I don't know. We really haven't delved into that deeply to see how they pass their laws. I know many of these capital punishment states, this has been law for a long time, since the 1800s.
Capital punishment goes back to revolutionary days and even before that into England. And then in the 19th century, Michigan was the first state that abolished it. And, of course, everybody had to rewrite their statutes in the middle 1970s after the Supreme Court declared it unconstitutional. But just how many now rely on the Constitution, how many are just statutory, I don't know.
Well, thank you. This is 2004, though, and I appreciate back then it's a different era than now, and I would hope that we would think about what we're doing at this stage of the game.
All right, thank you, Mr. Kittle. Feel free to stick around for the balance of the hearing, but this time I am going to proceed with the testimony, pro and con. We have, I believe, 14 individuals that have notified the committee of their desire to testify, so we're going to start in the order that they appear, giving equal time to pro and to con. And then when we get through these listed testifiers, then I will see if there's anyone in additionally in the audience who is not listed has an opportunity to testify at the end. Thank you. Ms. Sue Blees, President, Fight for Justice, if you'd step forward. And committee members, if you have questions of each individual witness, please make note of them or write them down. I prefer not to interrupt any testifier, but to see if there's any questions at the end of their individual testimony. We'll go to it at that time. Ms. Blees, go ahead. Identify yourself for the record.
Sue Ann Blees. Originally, I came here today with something wrote up. I'm prepared to speak to each and every one of you. And just sitting here, listening to some of the comments and questions that are being made, this is not an issue about Drew Shedeen. Drew Shedeen did happen to come up regarding this because her crime was heinous, okay? I'm here on behalf of my friend and her family that was murdered in Long Prairie. Okay, we have been running a petition for the state of Minnesota since April, since this heinous crime has happened. I have over 3,500 supporters, with a website continuing on with more signatures coming as people are more aware of the situation. As far as cost issue goes and as far as the citizens go, we are currently paying for these murderers in our justice system right now. Okay? We cannot forget about that. These people, if we have the death penalty, we would be able to, once they are convicted with the death penalty, and or not convicted, but say that they've committed a capital murder. Once they've been committed with that, you still got the prosecutor able to give them a life in prison without parole. Right now, all we have available is life without parole and a life sentence. Okay, and if you want to cut the cost of these hearings, you have to give them the opportunity to drop it down to life in prison, which life in prison in Minnesota is 30 years. Okay, and my concern is that these murderers and these people that are committing these heinous crimes do have the opportunity to get out. They do have the opportunity to go and commit again. They do have the opportunity in prison to kill an inmate or kill a safety guard or whoever. So that is one of my concerns. And I would like to go on with what I do have here, and I am prepared to answer questions at the end if there is any. Undoubtedly, this is a remarkable event, and not only on a personal level, but also for our perspective. For this marks the first time that this bill of this nature has been granted an opportunity to make a case here in this distinguished chamber, and I do want to thank you for that. I come with the intent of speaking softly, but carrying a big stick on behalf of this bill. For too long, those who work to abolish the death penalty have been able to flood the marketplace with free ideas with their arguments and perspectives. This is particularly true in our media and some of our church parishes. The diet of information you have already received could hardly be called balanced. What you are being asked to do is not cast a vote based on your personal viewpoint concerning capital punishment. You are not a jury, not a prosecutor, nor judge, nor executioner. Rather, we are asking you to improve this bill and let the citizens of Minnesota freely decide at the ballot box to approve or reject this bill. This is a question of allowing choice. Choice is a term which comes up in multiple ways in this issue. The person who commits a crime of premeditated murder is a part of their twisted free will and distinctively chosen to further their own desire at the cost of depriving the lives of others. Avoiding the death penalty is a simple matter of choosing not to kill someone, particularly in a cruel manner. It is not a penalty which would keep you or awake or keep your eye awake at night, because we freely choose to accept the social contract of civilization, which expects the individual not to kill another. However, communitively as a society, we can grant the state under which we live greater powers than those of an individual. If I were forcibly to take money from my neighbor, that would be considered robbery or extortion. However, the state legitimizes that as power of taxation. Wrongdoers who commit robbery consequently are held against their will, an act that would be kidnapping if done by an individual, but incarceration by the state. When it comes to a matter of execution, it is important to clarify the difference between murder and killing. Murder is defined as unlawful killing. The Ten Commandments, according to the original Hebrew, read, "Thou shalt not murder." This is quite distinct from the prohibition on killing as a whole. Society recognized that killing is something which is necessary justification under some situations, be it in self-defense under a violent intruder or why we arm our law enforcement officers and soldiers. However, the reinduction of the death penalty law will not lead to an open season against criminals, for it will require a grand jury to choose and indict an individual on the charge of capital murder and for a jury to unanimously choose the aggravating factor of the crime committed outweigh the mitigating ones in order to sentence the defendant to death. Choice is not something afforded to the victims whose tragic homicides spurred us here today considering this issue. Our friend Katie Zapzaka, her family Jared Zapzaka, her mother Holly Cromie were all brutally murdered in April by two men who abruptly entered their home almost 4 o'clock in the morning and tortured, beat, and raped our friend and then ultimately slit their throats. I cannot imagine anything worse than being woke up in the middle of the night in your own home of 3,000 people. Things like this do not happen there. And this very well could have been any of your families. William and Claudia Schwartz of St. Paul were also murdered by these two same exact murderers 9 days before the fact. There is also a case of Drew Shadeen. Drew Shadeen has made good choices during her life. She was, by all accounts, a hardworking and productive young lady who was on the cusp of going into young adulthood. But her final hours were deprived of her rights. Her attacker freely chose to target her and abduct her and dispose of her in ways we have not discovered yet. This is not a measure born out of raw anger or bloodlust, but this is not a bill about seeking revenge. This is about standing up for the concept that murderers should potentially face forfeitures of their own lives as punishment. Some will suggest life imprisonment as an alternative. However, even if they manage never to make parole, their fate is just the same as we seek, but it's delayed by 40 years or more. And what is accomplished in those 40 years? Perhaps some criminals will truly seek repentance, but for many it is a concept foreign to their minds. Rather, they will remain danger to their fellow inmates and correction officers alike. How many innocent lives must continue to be put at risk and sacrificed against the violent whims of the lawlessness? What fate does the killer already have behind bars to deter punishment from committing further crimes? All Minnesota law has now is the possibility of another life sentence, the equivalent of telling him to go to his cell and sit in the corner. Our written report will provide full documentations of our claims as well as nullifying the claims you are certain to hear from our opponents. We can develop a system which is fair to defendants, but also fair to fulfilling the moral outrage we feel when we hear of young women and families being murdered by predators and police officers being slain in the line of duty or victims being shot during an armed robbery. Again, I would like to state that this is a choice. We are here to ask you not to decide on this issue as a personal level. We are asking you to approve this bill and let the citizens of Minnesota freely decide at the ballot box to approve or reject reinstatement on the death penalty as punishment for these crimes. Thank you.
Thank you. I don't see any questions at this time. You take your seat. Mr. Stephen Baker, Eagan City Attorney, you're next. Mr. Baker, have a seat. Mr. Baker, go ahead. First state your name. Please keep your remarks to no more than 5 minutes, if you will, please. Thank you.
Mr. Chair. I'm Stephen Baker, and as you noted before, I am a municipal prosecutor here in the state of Minnesota for several cities in both Dakota County and Hennepin County. Let me give the folks here today a little bit about my background first. Even though I've been prosecuting here in Minnesota for a while, and we obviously do not have a death penalty at this time, especially for the municipal prosecutions I engage in, I also had a virtually 10-year-long career in another state of Florida, that has a very active death penalty. I spent several months first there as a public defender in Orlando. Then I went to be a state attorney, which is roughly the same as county attorney, in Brevard County, which is, for those of you who know it, around the Kennedy Space Center area. Thereafter, I spent 8 years in the Attorney General's Office of the state of Florida. And therein, I had an opportunity to work on three individuals who had received the death penalty. The work with the Attorney General's Office, as if this bill passes, would be similar work performed by this Attorney General's Office, was in the post-conviction field. Those are the areas in capital punishment where the ideas that we have tossed around today are fought sometimes for 10, 15, and 20 years after a death sentence has been imposed by a jury. That's what I did. I handled these cases on direct appeal to the Florida Supreme Court, on federal habeas to the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals, and on appeal finally to the United States Supreme Court. I worked on the three individuals who, between them, had killed 5 people throughout their lives. One individual in particular had killed 3 individuals. He had killed his first wife, was convicted of second-degree murder in the state of Florida, received a minimal 10-year sentence, got out within another 9 months, had killed 2 more people, including an infant child that he stabbed 33 times to death out in a field in the middle of rural Florida. I've had the very unfortunate experience of having a Supreme Court decline to sustain a death penalty and have to get a hold of the victims, the family, and tell them that they're going to have to go through a very long and very torturous capital trial all over again, and then wait all those years, 10, 15, 20 years, to see that there's some vindication and some justice against the person that took the life of their loved ones. Pretty hard to deal with it many times. I still think about that to this day. I too had a long prepared list of things, but in listening to some of the comments here today, and it may seem odd that somebody who's in favor of the death penalty in Minnesota would be speaking about things that would seem to be based upon the considerations of those who oppose it. But when I took a look at this bill, a number of things struck me, and I have great admiration for Mr. Kittle here. What it seems to be is that we have taken great pains to ensure that the defendant gets not just a fair trial, but the fairest trial possible in the United States. And I'm quite certain that in this state of Minnesota that would happen. I just take a look at around in the bill and some of the exclusions that right off the bat would prevent some of the things that we've talked about here that perhaps happen in other states would not ever happen in Minnesota. Somebody who's 18 years old or younger could not be given the death penalty. Mental retardation or mental illness can be raised at every step of the proceedings, even proceedings after conviction, to delay and ultimately thwart a death warrant signed by a governor or at the petition of the Attorney General. There's been a provision for foreclosing all doubt before the death penalty could actually be imposed in this state. Whether an individual is pregnant is also a matter for consideration to determine whether or not somebody's going to be ultimately put to death. Even though the statute goes into a wide variety of aggravating factors, I take special notice of all the task force and commissions that have been set up in order to safeguard every last conceivable right that a defendant may have in a capital trial. Of particular note is the fact that the prosecution is called upon in a series of checklists promulgated by the Minnesota Supreme Court to engage in a, I guess you'd call it brainstorming, with the defense to think of every avenue of defense for the defendant. I've had an opportunity to look at other death penalty statutes in other states. I have never seen one that actually called upon the state, the prosecutor, the people that apparently have the motive to have somebody put to death, be engaged in their actual defense from the outset.
Mr. Baker, would you begin concluding your remarks?
Thank you. All in all, as an experienced capital lawyer, if I were given somebody who was put to death in the state of somebody sentenced to death in the state of Minnesota the opportunity to work on their appeal, quite frankly, with this bill, only the worst of the worst, as it's been put, would end up being executed. I could probably, especially for the first few individuals given this sentence, tie Minnesota up in court, both state and federal, for many, many years, if not decades, based upon what's in this bill. I'm confident that every safeguard possible has been thought of by Mr. Kittle, and this will probably be, as he explained, a model for the entire United States.
Thank you. Any questions? Seeing none, you vacate the table. I'd appreciate it. To assure that we have equal time for testimony this morning on both sides of the issue, I'm going to shift on the proposed agenda. This time we'll go to Mary Struford, James Lim, and Joe Callahan. They've asked to be identified as a group. Step forward. We'll now proceed to some anti-testimony. There is an audio record being made, as you've noticed. Please give your name before you start, and then go right ahead. Paige, if we could find an additional chair.
My name is Mary Struford, and I currently reside in Duluth, Minnesota. On June 15, 1991, two men with guns kidnapped our 18-year-old daughter, Karen. She was found 5 days later raped and murdered. Both men were tried and convicted of first-degree murder and are currently serving life imprisonment. A source of joy is gone and dreams have been destroyed through cruel, terrifying, and wanton criminal acts. Still, we find no belief, logic, or motive to support the death penalty, no penalty or punishment can replace our daughter. We find no healing or comfort in the thought or prospect of any murderer's execution. Another deliberate and premeditated death only brings more sorrow, displays more violence, and provides only an avenue for revenge. We see no sweetness in revenge, only bitterness and alienation. We see no motive for the death penalty other than abusive exercise of vengeance. We believe we each have an obligation and a means to contribute to the prevention of further acts of violence. This obligation and opportunity is on our shoulders, no less than it is upon yours, and no less than it is upon a murderer's. It has been our experience that healing occurs when we face and confront the killers of our loved one. We look with hope for something of value to evolve when we struggle for meaning and accountability, especially with those we perceive as different than us. And we anticipate greater strength is to be found amidst the loss and void as we acknowledge, together with our offenders, our own and each other's grief and vulnerability. With the death penalty, we destroy these opportunities. More is lost than gained from exercising the base desires met when we kill. The death penalty denies each of us, citizens, lawmakers, and offenders, self-worth as well as a way to a more peaceful community. The death penalty denies opportunity and hope. We have been denied more opportunity and hope than we ever imagined we could lose. Don't deprive us, our families, and our community of more by legislating the death penalty or by creating a referendum to determine if Minnesota will allow executions. The death penalty is a response to fear, a desperate cry of rage and hate, an act promoting further alienation and a wasteful use of our state's fiscal, spiritual, and human resources. Instead of formulating ways to administer punishment by adding injury to injury, we ask the House to allocate the state's limited resources to pursue an alternative vision. Challenge and empower our educational, medical, human service, law enforcement, judicial, corrections, and economic systems to collaboratively address issues of peace and justice. Identify and support systems, institutions, and programs which help each of us be aware of violence in our lives and responsible for more peaceful homes, neighborhoods, schools, places of work, and community. In short, rather than pursuing the death penalty, continue to direct the resources of this state towards healing and restitution for the victims, accountability and habilitation for the offenders, and restoration of our communities. This was the statement that my husband Don and I provided 12 years ago when this issue came up. After 12 years of reflection, study, discussion, and healing, our statement and position remains today. We are proud of our state's refusal to use the death penalty. We are proud of our state's wisdom and strength to identify and engage victims, offenders, and community strengths and resources to seek and acquire justice. Justice that restores, renews, and empowers hope and faith in the capacities of each of us to contribute to the well-being of our communities. If it is wrong to kill, it is wrong for the state of Minnesota to kill. My husband Don and I join with others in our state and nation, such as Murder Victims Families for Reconciliation, calling for the abolition of the death penalty. To those who say society must take a life for a life, we say, not in our name. Thank you very much for this opportunity.
Mary Struppert, thank you for your testimony. As I understand, Mr. Lim and Callahan do not choose to testify, but are here just to provide support. Am I correct or not?
I think we're here to testify just for a moment.
All right, go ahead. Give us your name and go ahead.
My name, God help me, is Jim Lim, and my parents compounded that by giving me the middle name of Timothy. Come on, now, it wasn't that funny. 9 years ago, my only son, Michael, was murdered by two individuals who robbed him and killed him. And there's nothing in the world that ever prepares you for that particular phone call. Your life, as you knew it, came to a stop. And at that moment, you had the option of doing one of two things. You could live a good life. It would be a different life. It would not be the same life, but it could still be a good life. Or you can wallow in misery and hate, and that's a bad life. Well, we chose to, my wife and I and the rest of my family, to live a good life. And so during the last 8 of those 9 years, I've spent a lot of time at the prisons talking mostly to murderers. And I'll tell you very briefly about 2 particular programs I was involved in. There was a 10-week session at Shakopee in which we had 6 ladies, each of whom had murdered somebody. The theory of this particular thing was that on each night one of us would tell our tale, alternating between victims and murders. By the time we got done with those 10 weeks, the first night was very uncomfortable. They sat over there, we sat over here, and looking at each other was difficult. By the time we got done, we knew these people. We'd heard their tales. Most of them had hideous tales of abuse while growing up. Not all of them, but most of them. Some of them had been involved in drugs, but none of them deserved, in my mind, to die, even though they had killed somebody. The program at Lionel Lakes was a 10-week program, and there we had 5 murderers, 5 members of the public, and 5 victims. Again, we met with these people over that length of time, listening to their tales, us listening to each other and telling our tales, and came away with the thought that these people were people, and they did not deserve somebody to either stick a needle in their arm or pull a switch and kill them. In my mind, to legislate murder, which is what we're doing if we approve the death penalty, you have created just one more murder, and this time it's the state of Minnesota. I think that's a sinful thing to do. Of these 11 people, I'm sorry, that we got to know in the 2 sessions, I would venture to guess none of them will ever reoffend. I think that's a better way. Sadly, those programs have been discontinued because of financial dilemmas. I never could understand that response to us, in that each of the persons that I knew who were participating, we did it free. Didn't cost anything. We can solve your fiscal problem very simply by just telling you, vote no. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Callahan, did you have anything to add?
Yes, sir. My name's Joe Callahan. I live in Minneapolis, and I work at the Ford plant here in St. Paul. My younger brother, Henry, was murdered at the age of 24 in a restaurant robbery in Boulder, Colorado. My brother was a very personable, outgoing, well-liked young man, and also an athlete. At the end of the night of June 30th, 1982, a man named Thomas Weigard robbed the restaurant, insisting there was more money somewhere else, informed there was not, shot my brother in the head at point-blank range. So then in the middle of the night, my parents received a call back in Illinois telling them this horrible news. In the midst of their tremendous grief and pain, they made phone calls trying to arrange to donate organs from my brother's body to people in need of transplants. Unfortunately, donor organs have to be taken right away, so they were only able to donate my brother's eyes. Proponents of the death penalty use as a major argument that the death penalty is for the benefit of family members of murder victims, is to bring closure for them, to even the score, supposedly. I don't buy this. Does sitting behind a glass partition, watching state authorities kill a death row inmate, really erase the loss of a loved one who was murdered? Does it bring them back? Does it somehow close out the grief and pain of a murder victim's family members? I think not. I'll never forget my brother or how he died. Another reason there's no closure from the death penalty is that the victims of those executions have family members as well. So now they have also lost a family member. And many times those who are killed by the state are no more guilty of murder than those of us here in this room today. And for those family members of people who are executed, there'll be no revenge in the form of a death penalty for the killers, because the killing is perfectly legal. It's ordered by legal authorities. In closing, the last person I believe was executed in Minnesota was over 90 years ago. I strongly encourage state legislators and all Minnesotans to oppose to the idea of turning the clock back over 90 years and reinstating the death penalty. Thank you.
Thank you. Next, I'd call the Most Reverend Bernard Harrington, Bishop of Winona, representative of the Minnesota Catholic Conference. Step forward, sir, and take a place at the table. This is an audio record. If you'd give us your name, and in deference to any witnesses to follow, I'd ask you to limit your time to 5 minutes, please.
Good morning, Chairman Smith and members of the committee. I am Bishop Bernard Harrington from Winona, Minnesota, and I am the Roman Catholic Bishop of the Diocese of Winona. And I speak here today on behalf of the Minnesota Catholic Conference and all the Catholic bishops of the state who represent 725 parishes with a membership of 1,250,000 Catholics throughout the state. I really am very appreciative to have this opportunity to speak with you today, and I join with the other clergy who will be here presently to talk about this issue. I was shocked, like many other Minnesotans, at Governor Pawlenty's surprise announcement that it was his desire to reinstate the death penalty in our state. The Catholic bishops of Minnesota responded immediately in our open letter to Governor Pawlenty on December the 10th, 2003. We stated, "We encourage you to confront crime without vengeance and resist injustice through non-lethal methods. We are convinced that there are alternate solutions that can be enforced and do not require the taking of another human life." Our letter did not represent a new position or change of policy of the Catholic Church. Rather, it reiterated and emphasized a consistent pro-life message expressed through the principles of Catholic social teaching. The message stated briefly is that all life is sacred, and every human person is created in the likeness and the image of God. We don't pick the lives that are sacred and which ones are not. As a society, our challenge is to seek solutions to crime that both respects the dignity of human life and preserve justice. Capital punishment does neither. I am sure that your committee has heard about the political, the financial, and the social implications of capital punishment. But what we represent of religious organizations today, we bring together is the importance of the moral and the ethical considerations, the questions of conscience. Life is a gift from God, and all life is sacred. God gives and God takes away. Pope John Paul II, in his visit to St. Louis, Missouri in 1999, pleaded with the governor of Missouri not to impose the death penalty on the convict Daryl Meese. He stated clearly that the moral considerations for the use of capital punishment no longer exist in our present-day society. The death penalty itself is an act of violence. We continually see that the insanity of the principle, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth, which is the basis of the use of the death penalty. The ongoing slaughter in the Middle East, Iraq, and Afghanistan, as recently what happened in Bosnia and Serbia, testify to this violence. We need to raise our moral standard of living to the golden rule: do unto others what you would wish them to do unto you. I applaud the citizenry of our state, who for these past 100 years have upheld and continue to hold and fight against that mild capital punishment and maintain a higher ethical code. Yesterday, throughout our country, Mel Gibson's movie The Passion of Christ opened. It's the story of the last 12 hours of Jesus. Let us be mindful that Jesus was a victim of the death penalty. Jesus has taught us that he did not wish the death of a sinner, but his repentance. May we keep this teaching and moral standard in our state. That's one of my shorter homilies. Thank you.
Reverend Harrington, thank you. We normally conclude at noon. I'm going to extend only 5 minutes more, so we may have only time for one of you, reverends or rabbis, so we'll go to Reverend Peter Rognes. Next, state your name and go ahead.
Thank you. Good morning. I'm Peter Rognes, Bishop of the St. Paul Area Synod of the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America. In 1991, my denomination, which was then only 3 years old, after a broad study involving congregations around the country, adopted a social statement opposing the death penalty. Other denominations have done so as well. We do so not because we take lightly the hurt that is experienced by victims of heinous crime. The church is often the place that these people turn to for support and understanding. We know the hurt, and we walk with them. And we take this position not because we're soft about the danger that hardened criminals face for our pose for our communities. We too care about creating safe communities and reducing violent crime. It's out of concern for what kind of communities that we shape that I speak in opposition. A public policy of killing criminals does not make us a better or safer society or a more noble or humane society. It reduces us to being vengeful as a matter of public policy. It's a policy focused entirely on personal retribution rather than on addressing the issues of violent crime. The death penalty is not justice. Despite efforts to the contrary, the poor and persons of color are disproportionately killed by the state. 95% of death row inmates are represented by public defenders. The poor, often poorly defended, bear the brunt of the death penalty. It does not bring justice. It's not wise or humane use of all too scarce public dollars. Despite efforts to the contrary, studies in a number of states show the process leading to execution is costlier than life imprisonment. Better schools, job training, housing, public safety, social services, these will make us better and safer communities. The death penalty won't. The death penalty simply declares that a human life has lost all worth. We don't believe that. The death penalty makes law out of the human urge to get even. It doesn't undo the crime. It doesn't bring healing. It doesn't make us a more civil or just people. It's not justice. It's vengeance. It's not lifting the value of human life. It's making it a commodity to be taken away by a society that's failed to value it highly. It cheapens all of us. We can do better than this. We can be smarter, more noble. We can set our sights on being a more civil society than this. Thank you for your time.
Reverend Rognes, thank you. Committee members, we have not yet even gotten through the list of scheduled witnesses. There remain to be heard. We have not even gone then to the audience to see if there's anyone here who chooses to be heard on this issue. It's been pointed out by at least two committee members and the chair is well aware that we've amended this bill this morning. The fiscal note for that amendment clearly hasn't even been requested, nor do we have it. In light of those facts, the chair is laying this bill over on the table today. This meeting is adjourned.